150 years ago, the United States of America tried to tear itself apart. American blood and treasure from both North and South was spent in unprecedented amounts, and in the end gave birth to the nation we know today, the one that won two world wars, landed on the moon, and became a global superpower. One of the first centers of conflict in the U.S. Civil War was the Jackson Purchase, and over the next hour we'll hear how the first steps to victory and union were taken on the ground we stand on today. Come back with us as we remember the people, places, and stories of this defining struggle, the Civil War in the Western Rivers. This is the Civil War in the Western Rivers. I'm Todd Hatton. In order to fully appreciate what happened here from 1861 to 1865 and how it's affected who we are today, it's important to understand who we were in the years before the Civil War. For the first 70 years of our nation's history, West Coast waterfront real estate meant land in Hickman County, Kentucky. Kentucky's Transylvania University was a top medical school, and if you were looking for a horse or a mule, the bluegrass was the place to find it. Kentucky markets boomed with tobacco, hemp, cotton, and yes, slaves. And as America approached the mid-19th century, Kentucky's Far West was still close enough to the New West to promise great things in the towns and farms that lay between the Ohio, Mississippi, Tennessee, and Cumberland Rivers. Then came the Civil War. All of a sudden, the Four Rivers went from being lanes of commerce and travel to invasion routes and supply lines. Kentucky's Jackson Purchase transformed into a vital strategic crossroads at the center of the conflict.
Abraham Lincoln, 1861. I think to lose Kentucky is nearly the same as to lose the whole game. Kentucky gone, we cannot hold Missouri, nor, as I think, Maryland. These all against us, and the job on our hands is too large for us. We would as well consent to separation at once, including the surrender of the capital.
And yet most people today seem to think the war was decided in the East, somewhere between Pennsylvania and Virginia. But what if they're wrong? What if the war was won here? Murray State University history professor Dr. William Mulligan says the reasons why that could be true are obvious if you look at a map.
It's primarily geography. The rivers are the access points to the South. We forget that, you know, there's no interstate highway system. River transportation is critical to the efficient movement of men and supplies. There are some railroads, although this area is not heavily infested with railroads. So the rivers are absolutely critical to supply and logistical support for the Army. Control of this area is going to play a large role in who wins the war.
And what was this area like in 1860? In his book, The Kentucky Brave, the late Frank Carvel writes that it was much like the rest of the Upper South, mostly agricultural, with tobacco, hemp, and to some degree cotton. Most industry and commerce could be found in the cities, Paducah, Columbus, Mayfield, and Murray. There was even antebellum iron production between the Cumberland and Tennessee rivers, ranging all the way from Trigg County in Kentucky down through Clarksville, Tennessee. This meant the Purchase had much more in common with the South than with the North or even the rest of Kentucky. West Kentucky Community and Technical College history professor Barry Craig.
You've got a much more southern populace to begin with. Now, commercial ties with Memphis. You've also got two railroads coming to this region. One goes to Paducah from the south, one goes to Columbus and Hickman from the south. So you've got this natural commercial tie, which is not to say Paducah didn't trade with Louisville and Cincinnati, it did.
So Kentucky's tobacco, horses, and hemp were bought and sold in both directions. One commodity, however, always traded south, slaves. Commonwealth, slavery was a fact of life.
Well, in Kentucky, the percentage of slaves in 1860 on the eve of the Civil War out of the population was 20%.
That's Dr. James Humphreys, a Murray State history professor who's researched slavery in the Upper South, which includes Kentucky.
Slavery wasn't just an economic system. It was a system of racial control. It was a system of white supremacy. It was a caste system, which everybody knew their place. No matter who your father or your family is, if your mother's a black slave, you're a slave. It sort of served as the basis of the white ego. Blacks were made for slavery, whites for freedom. So the economic and the, you know, the society of a caste system and the psychological aspects were extremely pervasive.
The 1860 census reports approximately 4 million slaves in the U.S., almost 39,000 of them in Kentucky's 16 westernmost counties. In fact, Christian County had one of the Commonwealth's largest slave populations, almost 10,000, ranking behind Fayette, Woodford, and Jefferson. Of course, the numbers are nowhere near the whole story. In the late 1930s, Murray, Kentucky resident and ex-slave George Scruggs recalled his story for the Federal Writers Project.
I was born right here in Murray. My boss, the old man that I belonged to, was old man Vol Scruggs. I thought a heap of him, and he thought a heap of me. My old boss and my mother was play children together. I was just a small boy when my boss carried me away from Murray to Lexington. When my old boss sold out up there, he brought me with him to Paducah. That was the last time I ever saw my good old boss.
In hearing Scruggs' story, one wonders, did time soften the memory of a long-dead former master? Maybe Scruggs was simply telling a white writer in the Jim Crow South what the old man thought he wanted to hear.
How do you really know what blacks felt? Because they had to survive, and so they had to compliment whites when they didn't want to, and had to act like they were happy when they didn't want to. And so to say what they went through, it was a great front that they put up. And it's amazing they got through it as well as they did.
That front may not have come down in the racially charged post-war period, not when the wrong word or glance could end badly for an African-American. It was a way of coping, a strategy that had its genesis in antebellum slavery.
Historians have noted that they did have some ways of eking out some protections for themselves, that there was an informal system of reciprocity. Whites owed something to them, and then blacks owed something back, but whites were always in control. You know, one time there was a owner who was going to reduce the number of days the slaves got off for Christmas, and the overseer went to him and said, no way, you just can't do it. You know, they're going to revolt.
It seems odd to talk about slaves having days off, but it wasn't common. These were, after all, human beings who could be bought and sold by other human beings in much the same way you'd trade a car.
My mother and me were put on the block in front of the courthouse in Hopkinsville and sold to Mr. Newt Catlett. And we brung $500. My master was a good man, but my missus won't no good woman. She used to box my ears, stick pins in me, and tie me to the cedar chest, and whoop me as long as she want to. Oh, how I did hate that woman, Annie Boyd.
In a way, Annie Boyd was lucky. She and her mother remained together.
Kentucky law and most laws in the South do not recognize marriage. Even though historians have shown that most black kids knew who their parents were, and they lived in some form of extended family. But it wasn't recognized by law, which meant they could be broken up at any time. So it was a life of being subjected to arbitrary treatment and putting up this facade to try to avoid it.
Perhaps no piece of testimony gathered by FWP writers better sums up slavery's complexities than that of Mary Wooldridge. She lived near Hopkinsville, Kentucky, after emancipation. But before and during the Civil War, she belonged to a Washington County farmer, only a county away from Abraham Lincoln's birthplace.
I sure do remember Abraham Lincoln. My missus and massa did not like Mr. Lincoln, but all the Negroes did. I remember him. I seen him once, soon after I was freed. It was hard times during the war. My missus, some of the Negro gals, they chillin' had to stay in the woods several days to keep away from the soldiers. They ate all the chickens and killed the cows and took the horses. And we sure scared out there with them varmints roving around.
Mary's words might sound a little confusing. Dr. Humphreys suggests understanding may lie in the idea of a mask.
They were constantly under the control of whites. They constantly had a mask in front of them because they had to survive. Eugene Genovese, in his famous book, Roll, Jordan, Roll, he writes 600 pages on slavery, and at the end, he says, how do you judge a put-on?
I'm a soldier in the army of the Lord. I'm a soldier.
If slavery was closely tied to Kentucky's antebellum society, it was inextricably linked to its politics. Slavery and how the government dealt with it sparked heated rhetoric across the state, and it may have been hottest in the Jackson Purchase. Since the days of the great compromiser Henry Clay, Kentucky had been primarily a Whig state. The Purchase was the exception, consistently sending Democrats to Frankfort and Washington. These Democrats advocated states' rights, and Dr. William Mulligan says that usually meant one thing.
They're not fighting for the future right to issue driver's licenses and license plates. When you get right down to it, the state right that matters is the right to determine what the labor system will be in that state, to determine what the status of African Americans will be. If it was just about states' rights, it wouldn't have broken so neatly over slave states and not slave states. No non-slave state joined the Confederacy to defend states' rights. It's like whack-a-mole. People try to knock it down, but it pops up again. And it's hard to read much about American history in the 1840s and 1850s, especially political history, without slavery, the expansion of slavery, something to do with slavery coming to the fore. It's the central focal point of national political life.
In 1860, Crittenden County native Stephen F. Hale was a businessman living and working in Alabama. In the run-up to the war, the Alabama legislature sent him back to his home state to convince the General Assembly and the general population that secession was in their best interests.
Abraham Lincoln stands forth as the representative of the North, which, for the last quarter of a century, has been making war upon the South, resting its claims to popular favor upon the one dogma, the equality of the races. What Southern man, be he slaveholder or non-slaveholder, can without indignation and horror contemplate the triumph of Negro equality? The white man stripped by the heaven-daring hand of fanaticism of that title to superiority over the black race which God himself has bestowed. Stephen Hale, December 1860.
Hale thought he knew his audience. The problem was that Kentucky was a strong Unionist state. Even though native son Abraham Lincoln garnered less than 1% of total Kentucky ballots cast in the 1860 presidential election, a Unionist Tennessean named John Bell won the state. However, each of the four newspapers in the Purchase clamored for secession even before the fighting began. A January 1861 editorial in the Columbus Crescent said, "Kentucky may as well prepare immediately to go with the southern states into a separate confederacy. The sooner she does so, the better it will be for her." And the Purchase was ready. The region sent 83% of its military-age men to fight for the Confederacy. According to the Kentucky Department of Libraries and Archives, that's compared to 40% for the rest of the state. Abraham Lincoln's election to the presidency radicalized pro-slavery factions in various southern state governments, turning them pro-secession. South Carolina unanimously voted to be the first to go. Into the breach stepped Kentucky's U.S. Senator John Crittenden, who organized a last-ditch peace conference in early February 1861. Henry Burnett was Western Kentucky's pro-Southern 1st District U.S. Congressman and a peace conference delegate. A week in, Burnett wrote a friend in Madisonville that while most were optimistic war could be avoided, he wasn't.
"There's no perceptible change in the prospect of public affairs that induces me to believe that there is any hope of settlement of the disturbing questions now at issue between the two sections. The Republicans are earnestly engaged in preparing and passing measures that look to an internecine war with all its horrors." Henry Burnett, February 6, 1861.
Crittenden's peace efforts would ultimately come to nothing, turning the martyred abolitionist John Brown into a prophet.
"I am now quite certain that the crimes of this guilty land will never be purged away but with blood."
Just ahead, a pair of Confederate forts straddling the land between the rivers sparks the war in the West when the Civil War in the Western Rivers returns. You're listening to The Civil War in the Western Rivers. I'm Todd Hatton. The American Civil War began in the dawn hours of April 12, 1861, when rebel cannons opened fire on Fort Sumter, South Carolina. Fire. 6 weeks later, Kentucky's pro-Southern governor, Brian McGoffin, and the largely pro-Union legislature declared their neutrality and warned both sides to keep out.
I solemnly forbid any movement upon the soil of Kentucky or the occupation of any port, post, or place whatever within the lawful boundary and jurisdiction of this state by any of the forces under the orders of the Union or Confederacy for any purpose whatever, until authorized by invitation or permission of the legislative and executive authorities of this state previously granted. Governor Beriah McGoffin.
Neither President Lincoln nor his counterpart, Confederate President and Todd County native Jefferson Davis, were happy about Kentucky neutrality, but it would have to do. Oddly enough, Western Kentuckians responded by preparing for a fight. Paducah lawyer and future Confederate Colonel Albert Thompson even wrote to the Confederate Secretary of War begging for weapons to defend the purchase. Thompson's fellow Paducan Lloyd Tillman raised a regiment of McCracken and Marshall County men and led them south to Confederate Camp Boone in Montgomery County, Tennessee. Purchase politicians weren't standing idle either. In late May, with Kentucky neutral and Tennessee still yet to secede, President Lincoln received this alarming report.
A very delicate question is arising as to western Kentucky, that portion west of the Tennessee River. Lieutenant William Nelson will explain to you that a convention is now being held at Mayfield which may declare the Jackson position separate from Kentucky, and that this will be followed by an advance of Tennessee troops upon Columbus and Paducah. Major General George B. McClellan, May 30, 1861.
But the plan was short-circuited when Tennessee left the Union. The Kentucky-Tennessee state line became the Confederacy's northern boundary, but it wasn't a natural border like the Ohio River, and the Tennessee and Cumberland Rivers pierced it in two places, providing invasion routes deep into the South. According to U.S. Army Combat Studies Institute senior historian Kendall Gott, this meant problems for the rebel commander in the West, General Albert Sidney Johnston.
Being able to shift those forces, whether it's from Columbus or Bowling Green or elsewhere, the Confederate leadership really had to come up with that and then overcome transportation limitations. Three steamboats on the Cumberland, six, seven, eight on the Tennessee, and then the railroads with the different gauges and just not really moving in the directions you need. You had to come up with some plan to get a mobile defense in this western theater because the rivers weren't going to help you. In fact, they were going to hurt you badly, being a high-speed avenue of approach into your sector.
The rebels couldn't occupy the obvious positions in Kentucky, Columbus, Paducah, and Smithland, so Tennessee Governor Isham Harris ordered engineers to scout out locations for two forts, Henry on the Tennessee and Donelson on the Cumberland. Fort Donelson was built on the bluffs downstream of Dover. Fort Donelson National Battlefield Park historian Jim Jobe says Donelson's opposite number, Fort Henry, was truly opposite in at least one regard.
For some reason, they selected a site that was in the floodplain. I can't explain that. It didn't make sense to me. And so Fort Henry was built in a very, very poor location. Captain Jesse Taylor was sent in there as a artillery officer to supervise mounting of the heavy guns at Henry. And when he got there, it was obvious, yeah. He looked up on the riverbank and started writing reports back. There's high water marks on the riverbank above this fort. He sent another report back. I've interviewed longtime residents of this area, and they tell me this fort's going underwater with the spring rise. But he was a captain. He was told to shut up and mount the guns. The generals had made their decision.
In fairness, Johnston and his subordinate General Leonidas Polk may have been preoccupied. By mid-1861, Johnston was busy organizing defenses. Polk was worried about John C. Fremont. Both the Confederacy and the Union understood western Kentucky's highly strategic position, and both wanted to get there first. In late August, Major General John C. Fremont, head of the U.S. Army's Department of the West, decided to take the initiative. Neutrality be damned.
Brigadier General U.S. Grant, it is intended to occupy Columbus, Kentucky as soon as possible. You will, therefore, upon assuming the command at Cape Girardeau, take command of the combined forward movement. Major General John C. Fremont, August 28, 1861.
Polk got wind of Fremont's intentions and immediately dispatched a letter to Governor Beriah McGoffin.
I think it is of the greatest consequence to the Southern cause in Kentucky and elsewhere that I should be ahead of the enemy in occupying Columbus and Paducah. General Leonidas Polk, September 1st, 1861.
And 2 days later, Polk would get ahead of Grant's troops, at least to Columbus, Paducah would be different.
Arrived at Paducah at 8:30 this morning, found numerous secession flags flying over the city, and the citizens, in anticipation of the approach of the rebel army, which was reliably reported at 3,800 strong and 16 miles distant. As we neared the city, Brigadier General Tillman and staff of the rebel army and a recruiting major with a company raised in Paducah left the city by railroad. I landed the troops and took possession of the city without firing a shot. Brigadier General Ulysses S. Grant, September 6, 1861.
Grant's message to the citizens of Paducah struck a very conciliary tone, considering the city's demonstrated Southern sentiment.
I have come among you not as an enemy, but as your friend and fellow citizen, not to injure or annoy you, but to respect the rights and defend and enforce the rights of all loyal citizens. You can pursue your usual avocations without fear or hindrance. The strong arm of the government is here to protect its friends and to punish only its enemies.
Grant's occupation of Paducah forever deprived the Confederates of western Kentucky. It was also a foot in the door, setting the stage for the West's first major campaign. In November 1861, command of the Union Department of the West passed from John C. Fremont to Major General Henry Wager Halleck, nicknamed Old Brains. Whether it was because of his intellect or his intellectual snobbery depended on who you asked. Either way, Halleck understood the purchase's strategic importance. At his headquarters in late 1861, he demonstrated it for two of his staff officers.
General Halleck had a map on his table with a large pencil in his hand and asked, "Where is the rebel line?" General Cullen drew the pencil through Bowling Green, Forts Donelson and Henry, and Columbus, Kentucky. "There is their line," said Halleck. "Now, where is the proper place to break it?" And either Cullen or I said, "Naturally, the center." Halleck drew a line perpendicular to the other near its middle, and it coincided nearly with the general course of the Tennessee River. And he said, "That's the true line of operation." William Tecumseh Sherman.
Kendall Gott says hearing that would have shocked Confederate General Johnston.
He was focused like a laser beam on Bowling Green, and then secondary is the Mississippi. And that's a lot because Polk is out there. And just a casual look at the map, yeah, you can hold Bowling Green, but if they come up to Tennessee or Cumberland, the Union forces are now in your rear and about to cut you off. And putting a tiny little fort with 12 guns out there to defend the Cumberland and the Tennessee, you're building in a swamp, you know, come on.
But Johnston also had more mathematical difficulties.
The manpower of the Confederacy, particularly in the West, was just never going to match man for man the Union resources out there. So what the Confederacy had to do was rely greatly on these river forts to be key strong points to hold, but they never really had enough men to hold them. The Confederate leadership, in my opinion, should have come up with a far better way to deal with their defense than they ended up doing. For instance, they had a whole bunch of guys over in Columbus holding the line out there for an attack that never materialized because everything was happening off to the east.
Jim Jobe says Johnston may not have had much choice.
I hate to be too critical because I think they gave him an impossible job. They gave him this vast territory to watch and nowhere near the resources to do it. And he had two armies to worry about. And all these rivers, which were pre-war, had been such a great asset. I mean, they provided transportation, but all of a sudden, they gave the Union Army all sorts of places to invade on. And he had more rivers to watch than he had people to do, and he just couldn't watch everything.
One thing Johnston should have watched was the buildup of U.S. troops at Paducah and the increasing number of gunboats heading toward the Tennessee River. General Halleck's Old Brains had at last developed a unique plan to break the Confederate line. At 9 a.m., February 6, 1862, Grant and two divisions of 20,000 men landed on both banks of the Tennessee River north of Fort Henry. One division moved down the east shore to cut Henry off from Fort Donelson. The other moved on the incomplete, lightly manned Fort Hyman, positioned on the opposite Kentucky bluffs to cover the low-lying Henry. Seven Navy gunboats also steamed upriver to shell the position. It was over in 2 hours. Heavy spring rains and the rising river won the battle even before the first shot. With water rushing over his parapets, U.S. gunboats pounding away, one working cannon, and Union troops bearing down on him and already in Fort Hyman, Rebel Commander Lloyd Tillman surrendered himself, one gun crew, and Fort Henry at 11 a.m. The rest of his 2,500 men escaped to Fort Donelson. With Henry in hand, Grant wired General Halleck that he would immediately attack Donelson. Hearing no reply, Grant presumed Halleck's approval, but Halleck hadn't received any of Grant's messages, and he assumed Grant would wait 3 weeks to regroup. The disconnect was due to a rebel-sympathizing telegraph operator in Paducah who simply threw Grant's daily reports into the trash. No matter what, instead of 3 weeks, Grant would only wait 6 days.
I left Fort Henry on the 12th instant with a force of about 15,000 men divided into two divisions. 6 regiments were sent by water the day before. The troops made the march in good order, the head of the column arriving within 2 miles of the fort at 12 o'clock. The fortifications were from this point approached and surrounded. The following day, owing to the non-arrival of the gunboats and the reinforcements sent by water, no attack was made. But the investment was extended on the flanks of the enemy and drawn closer to his works. Brigadier General Ulysses S. Grant.
Fort Donelson historian Jim Jobe takes up the story.
Gunboats start arriving here on the 12th. And one gunboat at long range comes around on the 12th and again on the 13th and fires several rounds at long range. And the Union Army's arriving about that time, too. Grant wanted to get the infantry in place here to prevent an escape and then let the gunboats attack just like they had at Henry. And he's hoping that the gunboats will attack, control the river just like they did at Henry. He controls the river then with the gunboats, and he has them surrounded on the land side that he'll just wait for a surrender. He won't really have to attack with his infantry. But unlike Henry, his face is in a much stronger position here, and the gunboats were defeated.
In the first attack, Commander Henry Walk's gunboat Carondelet drew heavy fire. One shell pierced the iron armor and bounced around inside, wounding several sailors before shooting out and dropping into the water, still hissing. By the 14th, all the players were in place. Grant had encircled both Fort Donelson and the town of Dover. He then conferred with the commander of the gunboat fleet, Flag Officer Andrew Foote.
And he's urging Foote to attack. And on the afternoon of February the 14th, he does. All the Confederates have heard these stories about these monster boats that had captured Fort Henry. You know they're coming. And sure enough, around that bend, here comes the bow of one of those boats, and then two, and then three, and then four of those ironclad gunboats. Fort Henry is the first use of these ironclad gunboats that I can find in this country. So neither side knew what they're really capable of doing. They come around that bend of the river, which is a mile and a half away or so, form in battle line, and start approaching the fort.
Having little else to do that day, Colonel Nathan Bedford Forrest watched the spectacle from the bluffs. Turning to an aide, Forrest gave the former minister a piece of his mind.
Parson, for God's sake, pray. Ain't nothing but God Almighty can save that fort.
Before long, the South opens fire, because the South has 2 cannons that'll reach that range. And that's not enough to stop them. They keep pushing. And they're going to try the same tactic that they used at Henry, which was pull up as close as you could and blow it off the map. The gunboats continue to press to about 350, 400 yards. They're hoping the iron covering is going to protect them. But at that close range, they're really taking a pounding. And now they're so close, they're shooting uphill, and it made aiming more difficult. There's shots landing in Dover. But the Confederate aim got really good.
As the rest of the rebel guns opened fire, a round hit the pilot house of Foote's flagship, damaging the wheel, wounding Foote, and killing the pilot. His gunboat disabled, Foote allowed the current to take his vessel out of harm's way. Similar damage to 2 other ironclads sent them back down the river as well. That left Commander Walk and the Carondelet. Its steering was also damaged, but instead of drifting downriver to safety, it got caught on the opposite bank, in range of Donelson's guns.
And once it's by itself, apparently every Confederate cannon trains on it. And it really starts ringing their ears inside that boat. To make matters worse, it's got large iron cannons on it as well. These large iron guns sometimes explode. One of the Confederate guns at Henry blew up. The tube just can't take it anymore, and the tube explodes. Well, that's bad on the crew. One of those iron guns inside that boat blew up.
Before the decks were well sanded, there was so much blood on them that our men could not work the guns without slipping. Commander Henry Walk.
Mercifully, the Carondelet eventually falls back down the river out of range. In all, the fight between the water batteries and the gunboats resulted in 54 U.S. sailors dead, more than half of that number on the Carondelet alone.
So the South here had defeated those dreaded ironclad gunboats, and these Confederate cannoneers were very afraid when they started coming up here. And so all of a sudden they're falling back. So they start cheering and yelling and celebrating, and it was contagious. The fort starts cheering and celebrating, and that catches on with all the Confederates in the outside. So it is said that the hills and hollows surrounding Dover echoed with Confederate shouts of victory. It was a little premature because they're still surrounded by 27,000 forces.
The three rebel brigadier generals in charge of Fort Donelson certainly thought so. Since Fort Henry, command had passed to Kentuckian Simon Bolivar Buckner, Tennessean Gideon Pillow, and Virginian John Floyd. Floyd, being senior, was in overall command. The problem was Buckner and Pillow had hated each other since the Mexican War, and Floyd tended to make decisions based on whoever he'd talked to last. They did agree on one thing. They needed to leave. Thinking their 14,000 troops faced 40,000 Federals, far more than there actually were, they decided to pull out and join up with General Johnston in Nashville. To get there, they had to clear a path to the Charlotte Road, running east out of Dover. Throughout the 14th, the Confederates moved to their left, stripping their right flank down to 450 Tennesseans armed with shotguns. This one regiment faced the entire 2nd Division of the Union Army of the Tennessee. At 6 o'clock the next morning, six rebel brigades, along with 4th's cavalry, charged out of their works and smashed into the U.S. 1st Division southeast of Dover, driving them back almost a mile. Of the 1st Division's four brigades, two scattered, one ran, and a fourth was crushed as it came forward. By 1 p.m., the road to Nashville was open. Just then, General Pillow ordered the Confederates back to their trenches. Buckner objected, so the two took their dispute to Floyd, who sided with Pillow and ordered a retreat. Meanwhile, Grant was on the St. Louis, urging a diversionary attack on the shore batteries. But hearing the distant guns, Grant dropped the matter and raced back to the line as fast as the muddy ground allowed. When he arrived, he saw men just standing around.
The soldiers had their muskets but no ammunition, while there were tons of it close at hand. I turned to Colonel Webster of my staff and said, "Some of our men are pretty badly demoralized, but our enemy must be more so, for he's attempted to force his way out but has fallen back. The one that attacks first now will be victorious, and the enemy will have to be in a hurry to get ahead of me." I determined to make the assault at once on our left and called out to the man, "Fill your cartridge boxes quickly and get into line. The enemy is trying to escape, and he must not be permitted to do so." This acted like a charm. The men only wanted someone to give them command. Ulysses S. Grant.
Quickly and coolly, Grant did the math. If the rebels were strong at this one spot, they had to be weak somewhere else. And he happened to have a dependable commander at that somewhere else, his old West Point professor, Charles Smith.
We rode rapidly to Smith's quarters. I explained the situation to him and directed him to charge the enemy's works in his front with his whole division, saying that he would find nothing more but a very thin line to contend with. The general was off, going in advance himself. The outer line was passed, and the night of the 15th, General Smith, with much of his division, bivouacked within the lines of the enemy. There was now no doubt that the Confederates must surrender or be captured the next day.
Confederate Generals Floyd, Pillow, and Buckner agreed.
About 12 o'clock at night, I was called in council with the generals, who had under discussion the surrender of the fort. They supposed the enemy had returned to the positions they had occupied the day before. I returned to my quarters and sent out two men who, going by a road up the bank of the river, returned without seeing any of the enemy, only fires which I believed to be old campfires, and so stated to the generals the wind, being very high, had fanned them to a blaze. Colonel Nathan Bedford Forrest.
But the generals were unconvinced. Floyd said he would not be captured. He feared arrest over pre-war charges he had transferred arms to the South while Secretary of War. Pillow also stated he wouldn't be taken. In the end, Floyd transferred command to Pillow. Pillow, in turn, gave it to Buckner, and Buckner sent for a courier. Forrest had no intention of going quietly, at least into captivity.
I asked if they were going to surrender the command. General Buckner remarked that they were. I then stated that I had not come out for the purpose of surrendering my command and would not do it, that I intended to go out if I saved but one man.
Buckner told Forrest he could leave if he got out before the surrender became official. Forrest did, with about 500 men. On the morning of February 16th, Buckner wrote to Grant, "Sir, in consideration of all the circumstances, I propose the appointment of commissioners to agree upon terms of capitulation of the forces and post under my command."
"Sir, no terms except unconditional and immediate surrender can be accepted. I propose to move immediately upon your works. U.S. Grant, Brigadier General Commanding."
Believing he had no choice, Buckner agreed to surrender the fort and his troops. Not all the Confederates, however, were ready to give up. Some slipped past their guards, but most were shipped off to prisoner of war camps in the north. News of Donelson sparked bell ringing and celebrations in the North. In the South, it brought criticism and blame.
The enemy could not have reinvested their former position without traveling a considerable distance and camped upon the dead and dying, as there had been a great slaughter upon that portion of the field. And I am clearly of the opinion that two-thirds of our army could have marched, should have gained a glorious victory, as our troops were in the fine spirits, believing we had whipped them. Colonel Nathan Bedford Forrest.
U.S. Army historian Kendall Gott says that by later Civil War standards, Fort Donelson was a small battle, only around 41,000 Union and Confederates involved. But it was a loss from which the Confederacy would never recover.
This is where things started falling apart for the South, particularly in the West. A number of different things could have happened to go either way, but in my opinion, this is really where the door gets kicked in, and after this point, the South is in a position of trying to recover or at least hold back this slow but certain juggernaut from the Union forces that are going to just sweep through the Western Confederacy and eventually go all the way to Savannah and up into the Carolinas.
After Fort Donelson, Brigadier General Ulysses S. Grant became Major General Unconditional Surrender Grant. Along with Paducah, Donelson would be Grant's first steps toward Appomattox Courthouse.
Glory, glory, hallelujah, His truth is marching on.
When we come back on the Civil War in the Western Rivers, a new kind of Union soldier checks that devil forest in the River City. You're listening to The Civil War in the Western Rivers. I'm Todd Hatton. After Fort Donelson, fighting moved south and east to Shiloh, Vicksburg, and Chattanooga, to Parable, Antietam, and Gettysburg. U.S. Grant rose to command all Union armies by early 1864. His successor in the West, William Tecumseh Sherman, had a plan that he hoped would gut the Confederacy and shorten the war. He would seize Atlanta, Georgia, then march to the sea. But this meant a vast and vulnerable river and rail supply network spread out behind him across the Tennessee and Cumberland River valleys. Nathan Bedford Forrest, now a rebel major general, saw an opportunity. His independent cavalry, now including four West Kentucky regiments, the 3rd, 7th, 8th, and 12th, could slow Sherman down, or maybe draw him back north by tearing up track and raiding supply depots in the Federal rear, all the way back to Paducah, Kentucky. John E.L. Robertson is a longtime Paducah historian who's written four books about its history. He says the River City's geography kept it useful to the Union Army long after Grant and Sherman had passed through.
These waterways were vital because of the ease of moving goods, troops, and by water, where there was not other means. Railroads were just beginning to be used, and the Civil War was the first major war fought where the railroads supplied a great deal of the particular transport of supplies.
But as the war continued and casualties increased, that usefulness changed.
It was more vital at this time as a hospital center, because beginning with Donelson and some of the others, and particularly Shiloh, Paducah was a major center for rehabilitation. And one of the first things that the man that Grant left in charge here, General Smith, was to, he just requisitioned McCracken County Courthouse, and it became Federal Hospital Number 2. While the old Marine Hospital was Federal Hospital Number 1. And so they had about 8 hospitals in Paducah. And they had numerous people and numerous casualties that would be brought north and put in here for convalescence.
Robertson also notes that there may have been one other reason Paducah offered Forrest such a tempting target, something that stuck in the former slave trader's craw.
Paducah in 1864 was the first time that the federal government undertook to enlist blacks in the army. I think Forrest picked Paducah as his target to make sure that everybody understood that the South was not going to tolerate enlisting blacks in the army. And in fact, after he failed to take the fort in Paducah, He turned his Kentuckians loose so they wouldn't be involved in it. And then with his Tennessee and Mississippi troops, he stormed Fort Pillow on the Mississippi River. And there, he massacred black soldiers.
In late March 1864, Forrest crossed into the Purchase, sending 300 men back down to Union City, Tennessee. They captured both the town and 500 Union troops. Forrest paused at Mayfield before heading for Paducah the next morning, Good Friday, March 25th, 1864. And at a little after 2 p.m., the 3rd Kentucky's Company D ran into U.S. cavalry along the Mayfield Road just 3 miles outside of town. They chased off the Yankee patrol, killing one of them, and continued on. Forrest put Brigadier General Abraham Buford's Kentucky Division in front. Paducah lawyer Colonel Albert Thompson's brigade led the advance, spearheaded by the McCracken and Marshall Countyans of the 3rd Kentucky. They marched up the Mayfield Road, turning towards Broadway near today's VMV Railroad Yards. They arrived at the Caterjohn Building, a copse of trees at the time, shortly after 3. Union defenders fell back to Fort Anderson on the banks of the Ohio River. And at 4:30, the 3rd and 7th Kentucky dismounted and formed for an assault. Under a flag of truce, 6 men from the 3rd, including future Paducah Mayor Charles Reed, delivered Forrest's customary demand for surrender to the fort's Union commander, Colonel Stephen Hicks.
Colonel, having a force amply sufficient to carry your works and reduce the place, and in order to avoid the unnecessary effusion of blood, I demand the surrender of the fort and the troops with all public property. If you surrender, you shall be treated as prisoners of war. But if I have to storm your works, you may expect no quarter.
The answer came back quick.
I have this moment received yours of this instant, in which you demand the unconditional surrender of the forces under my command. I can answer that I have been placed here by the government to defend this post, and in this, as well as other orders from my superiors, I feel it to be my duty as an honorable officer to obey. I must, therefore, respectfully decline surrendering as you may require. S.G. Hicks, Colonel, Commanding Post.
And as if to underscore the point, the Union gunboats in the Ohio began firing into the town, rebels appearing in the streets. Colonel Albert Thompson then ordered his Kentuckians to advance on Anderson. The fort's heavy guns, manned by the 8th U.S. Colored Heavy Artillery and supported by the gunboats, drove them back. The attackers had also discovered Anderson's 10-foot ditch.
For some reason, I've always thought that was the poorest example of leadership I'd ever heard of out of Nathan Bedford Forrest, because you do not assault anything without a good reconnaissance. And the fort was just about shoulder high. But they dug out a hole that was about 10 feet deep. And so they had a real obstacle there. And so what they did, they retreated and got back in the second floor of the buildings that faced that area and sniped.
By the time Forrest called them off at sunset, the brigade had attacked and fallen back 3 times. Nevertheless, Forrest could and did call the raid a success.
While the move of a portion of the command was made against Union City, with the balance I moved rapidly on Paducah, drove the enemy to their boats and fortifications, held the town for 10 hours, capturing a large amount of clothing, several hundred horses, a large lot of medical stores for the command, burning a steamer, the dock, and all the cotton on the landing.
General Abraham Buford gave the order for Colonel Thompson and his men to fall back. Thompson was on his horse, not that far away, but he would never receive the order.
Colonel Thompson had halted his horse and stood a few feet east of the alley entrance, the horse facing south. The colonel was conversing with several officers and had his cap in his right hand held overhead at arm's length when the cannonball struck him and the animal. The horse ran half a block to 6th Street and fell, and was later buried on the spot. Private J.V. Grief, 3rd Kentucky.
The ball, fired from either the fort or one of the gunboats, arced in, gashed the horse's neck, and struck the pommel of Thompson's saddle. It bounced up, hit him in the upper chest, and killed him instantly. A more gruesome version tells of the colonel's spinal column being ripped from his torso and coiling up in the dirt like a snake. Mayfield's Colonel Ed Crossland took command of the brigade, and he managed to get his men under cover in a tobacco stripping factory before he almost immediately took a bullet in his thigh. From the factory, rebels kept up steady fire on the fort before withdrawing after dark. A newspaper account of the battle reported most Union casualties were from head wounds.
Could have held the place longer, but on account of the prevalence of smallpox in the place, I thought it'd be prudent to withdraw. Major General Nathan Bedford Forrest, April 15th, 1864.
When the battle was going pretty good, this one man recalled that he and his family went down and got on the boat, and they were going to row across and sit out the battle in Illinois. And the firing started with the gunboats, and he dropped down in the bottom of the boat. He turned over and looked at the woman beside him, and she had smallpox. When that word of that got out, as it did, some people feel that was what persuaded Nathan Bedford Forrest to leave as quickly as he did. The next morning, the Union commander sent the newly formed 16th Kentucky Cavalry under Burns out to burn those houses. And so they were the people that burned the house were burning their own houses.
A New York Times article from 1864 picks up John E.L. Robertson's story.
It was after dark when we landed at Paducah, but we walked up toward the fort through the smoldering ruins of the once beautiful city. The warehouses and dwellings exhibited prominent marks of the recent struggle. In many places, nothing but bare walls and chimneys were standing. Scarcely a building escaped the terrific fire of the gunboats, and many of them were completely riddled by shrapnel and solid shot.
And so Paducah, the town Grant took without a shot 2.5 years earlier, finally, deeply felt the scourge of war. For Forrest, the former slave trader, it was also something of a turning point. He'd seen his share of reverses before, but this time it came from the last place, or perhaps the last people, he expected.
New York Times, April 1st, 1864. It was the Negro regulars that fought so well. They handled the artillery with great skill, and their bravery is on the tongues of all the loyal men.
And in the report of their commanding officer.
In justice to the officers and soldiers under my command, allow me to say they acted well, proving themselves worthy of the great cause in which they are engaged, and all deserving of the highest praise. And here, permit me to remark that I have been one of those men who never had much confidence in colored troops fighting. But those doubts are all now removed, for they fought as bravely as any troops in the fort. Colonel Stephen Hicks, April 6, 1864.
The war dragged on for another 13 months before the last Confederates surrendered in June 1865. The violence, especially against newly enfranchised African Americans, lingered on. It's impossible to understate the U.S. Civil War's impact. Scholars have recently revised the number of Americans killed in the conflict up to around 750,000. That's about 2% of the country's population at the time. The equivalent number in today's population would be some 6 million. Kentucky's portion was between 33 and 38,000 dead, a third of the men who'd marched off to war. Figure slaves into the overall total, and some historians say the grand total could be closer to 1 million. The conflict devastated whole sections of the country, saw the murder of President Abraham Lincoln by an assassin, and altered the South's economic and social path for decades to come. Still, the Union was saved. And despite an uncertain future, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution had granted the rights of citizens to millions of African Americans. But back in 1865, soldiers of both sides returned home to the Jackson Purchase, some maimed in body or mind, to resume their interrupted lives. Some succeeded, others didn't. And some took up a new struggle against the new social order, where freedom was blind to the color of a person's skin, or at least was supposed to be. But as it often is with human beings, the more things change, the more they try to stay the same. Again, historian John E.L. Robertson.
The ethos of Kentucky politics after the Civil War. All of the people who joined the Confederacy were outlawed, and they had to apply to be readmitted. That had been done by about 1867. Most of them had already been repatriated. Now, they began to go back into Kentucky politics, and they became the natural leaders. And the old joke is that Kentucky chose to join the Confederacy in 1868. and it remained firmly Confederate. And Paducah, in particular, was adamant in its support of its Confederate history.
That's not quite as true in the 21st century. Our region's ever-changing demographics and the gains won in the civil rights movement have seen to that. What's certain is that we still struggle with what the war left undone, the issues of race, of memory, the very nature of our government. And until we win those battles, it may be that we will continue to hear the echo of those guns fired long ago. You've been listening to The Civil War and the Western Rivers. I've been your host, Todd Hatton. We'd like to thank retired West Kentucky Community and Technical College Professor of History, Barry Craig, Kendall Gott, Senior Historian at the U.S. Combat Studies Institute at Fort Leavenworth, Dr. Jim Humphreys and Dr. William Mulligan of Murray State University's Department of History, Jim Jobe, retired Park Historian at Fort Donelson National Battlefield, and John E. L. Robertson for their help and expertise, as well as Angela Hatton and Dieter Ulrich for their invaluable research assistance. We'd also like to thank Drew Adams, Squire Babcock, George Eldred, Elma Harris, Joe Haynes, Dr. Rusty Jones, Zuni Matima, Gary Pitts, David Shelton, Mickey Thomas, Robert Valentine, and David Weatherly for providing the voices of our historical figures. The Civil War in the Western Rivers is a production of WKMS News, written and produced by Todd Hatton and edited by Chad Lampe. Thank you for listening.